You're listening to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, archived at antiwar.com. Ah, the banality of evil. It really is impressive sometimes. Well, my example this week, I borrow from the LouRockwell.com blog, Alberto Gonzalez. This is an argument made by the Attorney General to Senator Arlen Specter, the inventor of the magic bullet theory, before the Imperial Senate just last week. Gonzalez, the Constitution doesn't say every individual in the United States or even every citizen is hereby granted or assured the right of habeas corpus. It doesn't say that. It simply says the right of habeas corpus shall not be suspended except by, and there he's going, referring to Article 1, Section 9. Inspector interrupts him to say, "You may be treading on your interdiction and violating common sense, Mr. Attorney General." And as some guy I'm copying said on TV last week, this guy's always been much more general than attorney. And it's just funny to see someone who's so thin personally, such as Alberto Gonzalez, be in such a position of authority to destroy our Bill of Rights and our way of life in this country. And to help me sit around and complain about that is Charles Featherstone. He's a former reporter and editor for wire services and papers in the U.S. and the Middle East. He's now studying for his master's degree at the Divinity Program at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. And he writes quite often for LouRockwell.com. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Good morning, Scott. How's it going?
It's going great. It's good to talk to you.
Not only is Alberto Gonzalez violating any sort of common sense, he's also going against, well, the whole notion of the founding of the Republic.
And how's that exactly going against, what is that founding notion that he's violating here?
Well, as Thomas Jefferson, who I think was probably the best of the founders, outlined in the Declaration of Independence, rights are inherent. In fact, governments are formed by people with rights in order to protect those rights. And they aren't given by government.
You know what's always been fun to me about that statement in the Declaration? Is he doesn't even try to prove it. He just says, well, it's self-evident to me and I'm armed, so what are you going to do about it? And that's basically what the Declaration says, right? It says self-evident because if, you know, you really get some philosophy professor in here to argue about it, we might all just be determined to believe in free will and who can prove otherwise. But you know what? I have a rifle and I say that it's self-evident to me that I'm born free and that if you're a tyrant, then you're unfit to be the ruler of a free people. How do you like that?
It's also a founding principle, meaning that if our discussion of rights has to begin there. And if it doesn't begin there, then it has to begin someplace else.
Right.
And unfortunately, our discussion of rights tends to begin someplace else, where Alberto Gonzalez begins it, which is that the state gives rights. And unfortunately, this has been the general overall approach of how both progressives and increasingly conservatives have seen how rights are constructed in the United States, that the state grants them to individuals. The difference being, in Jefferson's construction, and the way I think it really truly works, human beings, individuals, will the government into existence, will the state into existence, will the collective into existence. However, in effect, since the 1850s, 1860s, it has increasingly been seen that the collective wills the individual into existence. And as philosophical constructions, they actually have a tremendous impact on how one judges the power of the state.
Isn't that right? Because we sort of, we conflate and confuse the idea of natural rights and civil rights, like the right to vote being the same thing as the right to not be stabbed.
Exactly.
And really one is, in fact, habeas corpus is in fact not a natural right at all, and it's a civil construct meant to protect the natural right of an individual to be free and go where he likes. But in fact, even in the Constitution, it's referred to as the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus. This is a civil construction that people have made up to protect that natural right. And, you know, it's interesting, it's sort of the John McCain school of statism. I know you've written about this before. This there's an article came out just a month or so ago about John McCain's true convictions that what's most important in all of human history and you know, the overriding concern of all is that the American people must be made to feel that they live to serve the United States. And the fact that we don't all daily wake up thinking of how to sacrifice ourselves for the greater good is a terrible concern to him.
That's the progressive interpretation of history. I think, as I understand it, sort of began to be articulated that way with the Yankee abolitionists and the Unitarians. And it has been the majority view of essentially America's governing elites, and it has been the one that has been taught in our schools since the 1860s. Government is the author of freedom. Freedom is a government project.
Yeah, we hear this mostly in terms of the military, right? No matter what war we're fighting, even if it's the invasion of Panama or something, it's still fighting for our freedom.
Exactly. And it's interesting because this is now where sort of the Bushian conservative, and it goes a lot farther back than that. I came of age in the 70s and the 80s, and I don't get squishy feelings about the Reagan years in the Reagan Republican Party. That was an authoritarian, nationalistic, conservative Republican Party that was as militarist as this one. So their notion of individual freedom was always one that came second to their concept of the state.
Right. And now, what's funny about Gonzalez's argument here is he's right. In terms of, you know, what he's referring to, obviously he's got a false premise to begin with about the origin of liberty, but he says that the Constitution doesn't say everybody gets the writ of habeas corpus. In fact, the only mention of habeas corpus in the Constitution is in Article 1, Section 9, which is a list of restrictions on the government's power, where it says that you can't repeal it unless invasion or rebellion. And it always seemed funny to me that there is a restriction being placed on a power that was never granted to them in the first place. Shouldn't it be that if it doesn't say somewhere in Article 2 that Congress shall have the power to suspend habeas corpus, it makes no sense for there to be a restriction on a power that's never granted to them, which is me turning Alberto Gonzalez's argument right side out again.
Except that, as I understand it, there are a lot of things that are not specified in the Constitution, not only the freedoms that are supposedly protected by the Ten Amendments, but, oh God, and I wish I could remember, there was a conservative scholar I read, he wrote a fascinating book on essentially common law and property rights, and arguing that the founders had a much more expansive notion of what property meant, and that there were a whole bunch of things that they assumed going in.
Right, such as the writ of habeas corpus, of course, exists for all people of English-speaking descent and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the whole notion of human beings being free, in effect, from government control, again, those don't have to be explicit rights because that was not going back to the Declaration of Independence. That's not what they assumed. Lots of constitutions today, for example, make explicit guarantees of rights because the state is the author of those rights, as opposed to those rights precede the state. Whether you believe that they are inherent to being human or God gives them to human beings, they precede the state.
Right. This is something that really came to my attention when studying the UN Declaration of Human Rights in high school. I noticed that it basically pretends to acknowledge the right, really to grant the right to all people on earth, that they have the right to live in a country where the government is powerful enough that there's a regime of taxation strong enough that their central government shall provide to them a house, clothes, health care, education, you know, happiness, and everything else. And that this is a right. And I guess this is exactly what happens, isn't it, when we confuse where these things come from in the first place. We can't even differentiate your right to not be violated from your right to the violation of someone else.
Exactly. And that's why I think it's so important to focus on, because essentially the U.S. institutions, the U.N. is a reflection of a certain idea of what American institutions ought to look like. So one has to look at progressive history, particularly 19th and early 20th century progressive history, their view of the centrality of the state to creating a perfect society and essentially mobilizing individuals. And monopolizing how human beings would define their meaning. I don't know if these are... Essentially, the state, what it wanted to do in the 19th century was impose upon individual human beings the meaning of their life, what they would live for, what they would die for, what they would participate in. And that became a sort of progressive notion. Society would be organized by the state for the ends of the state, and individuals wouldn't have any choice as to how that would work. That became the march of freedom is how it came to be defined. It's the progressive teleological version of history.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the UN's founding institutions were designed by New Dealers. And that was their notion of how history worked and how institutions ought to work.
Mm-hmm.
They're American institutions. The UN, the World Bank, they are all American institutions, and they all reflect certain ideas, American ideas, of how the world ought to work. Not your ideas and not my ideas, but they're very American ideas.
Yeah, definitely not the Jeffersonian school, but...
Definitely not Jeffersonian school, and definitely not a certain kind of conservative school either, although it seems to me that conservatives long ago, and I would suggest it began in the 50s and was complete probably by the late 60s, made their peace with these international institutions.
Yeah, well, and really with the idea that if whatever right it is you're claiming doesn't exist where they can read it in the Constitution, then it just doesn't exist. I don't know how many times I've heard G. Gordon Liddy, for example, on the radio saying, there's no right to privacy in the Constitution. The court just made up this right to privacy.
Yes, I heard that a lot, too. And it's interesting because, as I noted on the LRC blog, that oftentimes comes with bundled complaints about ignoring the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. And the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution specifically says, just because something isn't stated as a right doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, they can complain about it being ignored just as long as they don't read it themselves, I guess.
Exactly. Well, they have other things that they're, you know, this is, again, they have other things that they want to accomplish. Regardless of how you think about abortion, and I do believe that the Roe decision was an exceptionally bad decision, to destroy an inherent right of privacy founded in common law because you don't like a particular Supreme Court decision is just simply bad thinking.
Yeah, it's cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, I guess part of the problem here also is that people just kind of assume that government's legitimate and that government is, I guess really most of all, that it's not self-interested,
mm-hmm.
that it's the impartial arbiter of justice and that kind of thing. And so I guess where it seems obvious to you and I that if you let the state define your rights or pretend that they're the origin of your rights, you're going to lose them. They're going to define your rights down as much as they can, for the most part. Maybe not on, you know, like Roe might be an exception, but here we have Alberto Gonzalez saying, I don't see anything in the Constitution that says I can't round up Americans and lock them in detention camps.
Mm-hmm. It's less that, for me, than it is just simply the state making the determination of what things mean from the standpoint that, you won't get the opportunity to say no to the state. You can't. You're not allowed. Now, it's true that in this whole approach that Gonzalez is taking, you could honestly say that, well, there's no explicit guarantee of assembly, merely the First Amendment saying that the Constitution can't say no to it. But we can, you know, as someone pointed out, the executive could just as easily say no, and that's not Congress making a law. The executive, it's merely the executive deciding to say no.
Right.
You could wish rights away very easily, particularly once they become grants. And if they become grants and you believe that in order for them to exist they have to be explicitly stated, and if they are nowhere explicitly stated, then they don't exist.
Yeah,
this
now,
is
what do you
very
make,
dangerous thinking.
What do you make of the argument, which, and I've had this argument with liberals before, who say, look, you can, you know, sit there and pretend it's self-evident that you have all these rights, but if you can't actually practice them, you don't have them. If we live in a country where the society, so-called, has decided that it's okay to take your house to build a road through there, or, they can do this, that, or the other thing to you, up into and including suspending habeas corpus and locking you away without trial, then you don't really have a right to be free, whatever, unless it actually exists in practice. They take your guns, you don't have the right to bear arms. You could say, I guess, that it was violated, but they would actually, I guess, argue that no rights exist except where they exist in reality in the civil construct.
And that's where culture, I think, is actually much more important than law. What I have discovered, or at least ascertained about law, is that the moment you start writing laws, people start looking for ways around them or through them or under them. Culture actually acts probably as a greater defender of liberty and a greater defender of rights than actual law does. And it's the combination of the two. Again, in the Jeffersonian construct, if enough people in the society believe that individual rights precede the state, then they will look at state activities in a certain way. But the moment enough people believe that rights come from the state, that the state grants them, then people will look at rights in a different way. So culture is exceedingly important. There are countries that don't have constitutions, for better or for worse, and there are societies where on the face of it, it looks like the people who run it can be fairly tyrannical, but because there are strong cultures of property protection, for example, and respect for families and other smaller, lesser institutions in society and individuals, you actually have a great deal more freedom and a great deal more tension because the society, because the culture, because shared values come into play to protect things.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in effect, it's more the shared culture than it is the law that can limit government. And I would suspect that no country of 300 million people can have a shared culture, and therefore all you have is law, and that's not going to be shared very much either.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I guess there's so much polarization. To a libertarian, it seems like the left and right really aren't much different. But there's so much polarization, particularly over the war, where you have society split into these red and blue states and all this kind of thing, and really neither side believes in liberty. So where does that leave us?
I'm not sure. I think that leaves us as the criers in the wilderness at this point. There are some things we need to remind people of, and if nothing else, it is that this is an important principle, that rights precede the state, that the rights to the individual don't come from the state and they aren't gifts of the state. Yes, state action can guarantee them and can take them away, but the intellectual foundation, the moral foundation, the philosophical foundation of rights preceding the state is crucial for us, and we need to harp on that.
Yeah. And really, you know, if the greater good is more important than the individual, then you're going to live in a place where there's no greater good at all, because all the individuals lost their rights.
And
how can you have a greater good if you're not free?
And because individuals can be sacrificed against their will, by people and against their own decisions, people can make the choice to take things or destroy people.
Yep.
And if it's for the greater good, that's why I'm not a big fan of the concept of greater good. You don't have a greater good unless you have everybody acting in effect in their own self-interests.
Right. You basically have to buy into the myth of the common good, which by definition would mean that everybody's for it.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it's not a common good.
The common good is usually something spoken of by elites who want to impose some sort of notion of what they think is right on others.
Yeah, on people who don't want to go along.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, this is Anti-War Radio, so let's change gears a little bit and talk about foreign policy. I really like your articles on LouRockwell.com regarding the war, and one thing that you've said is that basically Bush has waged war on the multinational order that the elite in this country have tried so hard to build since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if, you know, kind of in a dark way, whether we should be thankful for that.
Well, that's an interesting question. One has to understand that what Murray Rothbard called the Rockefeller World Empire, and I think it's a great term. It's the one I try to use as often as I possibly can. Sort of the formal, permanent foreign policy elite in this country. They bought into the whole Bush thing early on. But I think probably by 2005 had run its course. They're going to come out on top, I think, no matter what happens. And they've pretty well abandoned the Bush project. So, on the other hand, a lot of their formal institutions are a great deal weakened. They're deathly afraid of the weakening of American power, both hard and soft power, mm-hmm. and they want to preserve that as much as possible. On the other hand, they're very, very flexible, and they live in a sort of a placeless world where places are the same. It doesn't matter quite where you are. They live in a strata where it doesn't matter where you are, just so long as you believe in certain things and belong to it. And, you know, they're going to survive, even if they become much more of a transnational elite, and even if they buy into more of a collective decision-making from the standpoint of cooperative efforts with the European Union and other, quote, major powers, unquote. Mm. I think that they have probably decided that American unilateralism is not going to succeed.
Well, do you think... it seems to me, and I'm not really sure which all are the best ways to measure this, but it seems that institutions, American institutions really, such as the IMF and the mm-hmm. World Bank, and even, you know, like the project for the free trade area of the Americas, that was supposed to be complete 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and now it looks like they're going to try to go for North American Union first and then see about getting to incorporating South America later on. I sort of wonder whether the damage that's been done to these systems, I guess I wonder how much it set them back.
I'm not entirely sure these are going to be set back all that much, although who knows. But what they do, it's much like what kind of has happened with the European Union, and I suspect a process is similar. We've seen it with the WTO, and that's what I'm most familiar with because I covered the World Trade Organization. Is you create these unaccountable institutions, and then you invent this faux democratic process, this false democracy, by which so-called stakeholders, including non-governmental organizations, are brought in to represent supposedly the interests of groups of people in front of these organizations. And that's sort of the false democracy of the future. It's sort of a false institutional elite, democratic. Pretends to be democratic because it works kind of on a European parliament. It works on a parliamentary system representing blocks of people. And I think that that's going to continue to go ahead full steam. But I think it's going to matter less and less. In short, because I think international institutions are going to matter less and less.
Mm-hmm. And
they'll continue to exist, and they will continue supposedly to do their thing, to regulate and to manage. But there's, I think, going to be less and less for them to manage.
Yeah, you know, Jeremy Sapienza points out that really as governments, it's true, are getting bigger and more powerful, but not nearly as fast as their populations are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that really, well, I just saw the headline the other day. I couldn't believe it, but I guess, you know, it really does make sense when you take into account all the inflation and so forth that the defense budget, the offense budget, is actually a smaller percentage of GDP than it's been in a long time.
Yes, no doubt, and yet it's still way too big.
Way too big, but you know, to your point that really the IMF and the World Bank might run around offering loans to people, but if people don't want to be their customers and have other ways of raising capital and so forth, they're basically just going to be made irrelevant.
Or they'll have to be, or they'll have to coerce people into becoming customers. That happens too. So again. We'll see. I think the bigger governments, that simply because they'll, you know, these big international institutions that aim toward global management are going to find the job of managing the world, one that has been aspired to for a long, long time, just simply impossible. It won't be possible to manage the world. It just simply never has been, and I don't think ever will be. That doesn't stop people from wanting to do it or thinking they can do it or organizing to do it. It's just not going to be possible for them to accomplish it.
Yeah.
And eventually these things will fall apart. But not until after they've been in business for a while. I'm a bit of a fatalist on that, that standpoint.
It's really the question of how much damage they can do between now and then.
Well, they're going to be able to do quite a bit of damage.
Yeah, you know, I keep thinking, and I've been thinking this for years. First of all, I should say on the record, I don't think Hillary Clinton stands a chance because it's already the case that 40 or 45% or something of the American people hate her guts. And so you just can't start a presidential campaign with those kind of negatives. I like to believe that's the case, and we don't have, you know, the slightest chance of having to suffer under another Clinton presidency. However, I guess my nightmare is that she'll become president and the first thing she'll do is go to the United Nations and say, hand me 50 treaties to sign. And she's going to do the exact same thing that George Bush has done against multilateralism for multilateralism. She's going to turn it right back the other direction and be, you know, even worse than her husband.
She may. I don't think she's as much damaged goods as you think she is.
Oh, man, come on.
But not that I ever want to see her get to be president. I just think that after 8 years of Bush, anything is entirely possible.
Oh. All right, I accept that. Okay.
I don't mean to depress you, but I think it's. I don't think it's going to be quite that clear cut. But yes, there will be an attraction to the internationalism of the United Nations. But understand, it's going to be an American-centered internationalism, and by that, it will be again that these institutions, you know, are rebuilding the American-centeredness of these institutions, that they exist to serve American interests and reflect certain kinds of American values. And again, I mean that in a very limited sense.
Right, yeah. By American interests, you mean the interests of some politically connected corporations.
And the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, which is basically the foreign policy front for big business in America.
The Rockefeller World Empire.
Yeah, well, and I just had the discussion just now with Greg Palast about we went back and forth the whole time, but the interview ended on the question of the neocons want to bomb Iran and James Baker wants to talk to them, which is it going to be? And Palast says, well, if Baker wants to talk to him, we're going to talk to him. So
Baker,
I guess that'll be the test, won't it, of who's really in charge here?
I think so. About a year ago, when I was still working in Washington, I detected in a number of articles the beginning of the revolt by the Rockefeller World Empire against the Bush types. And I think the Baker-Hamilton report reflected the culmination of, we are no longer responsible for this. We are no longer taking responsibility for this. Junior and his people are completely out of hand. And I think it's possible that if George Bush feels he's cornered, he's still president, and he can still act under their, you know, fantastic interpretation of Article 2, who the president is and what he can do. But I suspect that Palast is probably right, that there will eventually be talking rather than bombing, although bombing is still a possibility.
Yeah, well, and we still have 2 years to go of this, unless Congress can get their act together.
Yep, but let's understand what getting their act together means. It's not a libertarian future for Congress. The next Democratic president wants to preserve presidential power.
Absolutely, and really, that's really the rub here, isn't it? That all these right-wingers who say, you know, hey, they're fighting terrorism, you know, you're being unpatriotic to question Alberto Gonzalez and his authority to protect us from the bad guys. They're really giving all this power to the next Democrat president.
Yep. The interesting thing, and this is, I think, how power works in the world. It wouldn't have worked this way 100 years ago when, say, for example, Teddy Roosevelt or Howard Taft was president. But the more actual hard, physical, real power the president attempts to accumulate around the presidency, the less actual power the president has. There's something Bill Clinton kind of understood, which is that presidential power is more sort of influence and is less formal. And the Bushies are actually going to wreck a lot of presidential power. And I'm not against that. I think that's swell. But the next president is going to revert to a more Bill Clinton-esque use of presidential power. We're not finished with the presidency as a problem by any stretch of the imagination. But the Bush people will have done a lot of damage to presidential power, and in the end, I think that has to be viewed as a good thing.
Check out Charles Featherstone. He writes for LouRockwell.com, and his blog is thefeatherblog.blogspot.com. Thank you very much for your time today, Charles Featherstone.
Thank you, and you have a good day.
You're listening to Chaos Radio, 95.9 and 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com.
Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.